There was a man named Levi who was a tax gatherer at Capernaum on the southwest shore of Galilee. Tax gatherers, or tax collectors, as we often refer to them as, collected taxes for the Roman Empire. A chief tax collector would bid on an area for the right to collect taxes from a certain group, certain location. And then that amount, though, was never reported to the public. So the chief tax collector collected whatever he could, gave what he said he was going to give to Rome, and kept the rest. The whole system lent itself to abuse. Chief collectors would get others to do the actual labor for them. These were often poor Jews who were desperate for work. But even these tax collectors were regarded as outcasts and traitors by their fellow Jews. Now, it seems to have been Levi's responsibility to collect tolls from caravans that were using the great road that went past Capernaum, that took people from Syria to Egypt and back again, as well as any duties on transported goods. One day, Jesus invited Levi to stop collecting taxes and become his disciple. Levi gladly accepted the invitation, and perhaps out of gratitude, later changed his name to Matthew, which means gift of the Lord. He later became one of the 12 apostles of Jesus. Now, many of the disciples were fishermen, and they were not exactly known for their literary skills. They did not have a lot of skill or practice in putting things down on print. But Matthew did, because of his job, it required such skills. And so along comes Jesus, and he calls Matthew away from the custom house to change that occupation and become his disciple. And Matthew rose up, and he left everything behind except one thing: his pen. And as he heard Jesus teach again and again and again, he began to write these teachings down. And so he put together an orderly collection of the teachings of Jesus. The question is whether what Matthew wrote down and the gospel that bears his name are one and the same thing. That's the question. In other words, who wrote the gospel of Matthew? The gospel itself is anonymous. There's no explicit reference to the author of the gospel. Now, you're thinking, no, wait, in my Bible it says at the top of the page, the gospel according to Matthew. What do you mean it's not listed? You have to understand that's something that the publisher put there. And most publishers follow that pattern. But that title is not part of the original document. The original document is anonymous. So the question, who wrote the gospel of Matthew? The short answer is we don't know for sure. It was the unanimous view of the early church that the author was Matthew, the tax collector, who became one of the original 12 disciples. Among those cited include Papias, and he was bishop of Hierapolis. And this dates from AD 140. He wrote, Matthew compiled the oracles in Aramaic, and everyone translated them as best they could. And there are other early scholars that mention Papias and the tradition that Matthew is the author. But on the other hand, most modern scholars think it unlikely that Matthew is responsible for the entire gospel. Rather, Matthew compiled the teachings of Jesus in written form using Aramaic. Aramaic was the language, the everyday language of Jesus and the disciples. Okay, over a long period of history, Hebrew kind of evolved into a much more folksy type language called Aramaic. They're very similar languages. But this is why Matthew would write it in Aramaic. That was the common language for them. So he wrote it in Aramaic. And then others translated it. And apparently somebody translated it into Greek and then incorporated it into this book we call the Gospel of Matthew. At least that's how the theory goes. This is consistent with the other synoptic gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the synoptics because they have similar points of view. That's what synoptic means. So you have Simon Peter being the strongest influencer on the gospel according to Mark, even though Peter did not write Mark. That's attributed to John Mark. And you have Paul being the greatest influencer on Luke and Acts, even though Paul did not write Luke and Acts. In a similar way, then, you have Matthew being the greatest influencer on the gospel, according to Matthew. At the very least, it means he has a significant impact on the content of Matthew, if he's not, in fact, the author. In any case, regardless of whether Matthew is the lone author or just the major contributor, this is an amazing book, this book of Matthew. It was the most popular book for the first three centuries of Christianity. And many critics, even critics of historic Christianity, have said, this is the greatest book ever written. So over the next several weeks, we're going to take a look at this greatest book ever written. It's going to be an overview of the book. We could spend months and months, even years, going through the book verse by verse. But I'm going to try to give you the big picture, look at the key parts and points of Matthew. You're also encouraged to read through the entire book on your own by April 23rd. Yes, you can do it. It's not that long. By April 23rd. Now, I know some of you have already started. And you got bogged down in chapter 1. And you're sitting out there thinking, what's he talking about? How can this be the greatest book ever written? Has he even looked at chapter 1? It's a long list of dead people. Who starts a book with a list of dead people? This is boring. Okay, all right. Now, in defense, ancient Jews were exceedingly interested in genealogies. Actually, most cultures throughout most of the world are interested in genealogies. Americans are kind of the exception. Maybe two or three of you are sort of or temporarily interested in genealogies, but most Americans don't care. So when they read Matthew chapter 1, they go, let's turn the TV on. Something like that. You're not interested, but this is exceedingly important. Why? Well, because no biography in those days would be complete without a family lineage. This established the importance of the individual. But it was also a way of showing that this person was real. Not a myth, not a legend, but an actual historical character. One of the mistakes that the Wycliffe Bible translators made at one point in their history, and they've translated the Bible into hundreds of different languages, some of whom didn't have their own written language at the time, is they would take, say, the Gospel of Matthew, and anxious to get at the substance of Jesus' teaching, they'd skip the genealogies. But then once the trucks arrived with the new copies of Matthew, the people weren't interested. They were more interested in the trucks than they were in the Gospel of Matthew. And then about 10 years after that, they finally finished the Matthew with the genealogies. And the lead translator in the case had what she thought a reason to give an excuse for this to the people, and they stopped her. You know, how come you didn't have the genealogy before? We didn't know Jesus was a real person. See? This establishes Jesus as a real historical person. Matthew also wants to make clear that Jesus is, quote, the son of David. That is to say, that Jesus is the Messiah in fulfillment of prophecy. Matthew writes, as a Jew who has found in Jesus the fulfillment of all that is precious in his heritage. Fulfillment. Fulfillment is a central theme here to this book. So Matthew seeks to answer the question, what does the gospel have to do with the Old Testament? What does the gospel have to do with the Old Testament? And one of the great objects of Matthew is to demonstrate that all the prophecies of the Old Testament are fulfilled in Jesus, and that therefore he must be the Messiah. Again and again, we have this repeated phrase, quote, all this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, end quote. Now that quote appears 10 times, or something like it, at least 16 times in the Gospel of Matthew. So fulfillment is crucial. Jesus is the fulfillment of Scripture. Now, back to the genealogy. In ancient genealogies, women were not included. Now, go back and read the genealogies. There are 5 women listed. And not only that, 2 of them are not Jews. Possibly a 3rd one. But that means about half of those are not even Jews. They're Gentiles. What's up with that? Well, he's implying that even from the Old Testament, God has had a plan. This plan for a mission to all the peoples of the world, to change lives, to bring people into a new relationship with God. It's an old plan to shape new lives. So Matthew has this Jewish perspective, and in keeping with a kind of Jewish perspective, he models his collection after the Hexateuch. Do you remember the Hexateuch? Some of you do. On that series we did on the Torah, we mentioned Hexateuch. All right. Maybe you remember the Pentateuch. Pentateuch is the 5 books, the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's the Pentateuch. Well, Hexateuch means 6 books, and that's the Pentateuch plus Joshua. Is some of this coming back, maybe? Oh, okay. So, you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. These books describe the organization of the people of God under the covenant of Moses. Then you have Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. These are known as the former prophets. And the link between them is the book of Joshua. In fact, the connection between Deuteronomy and Joshua is so close that that's where the term originated from. People thought in terms of 6 books, not just 5. So it's the Torah, the Pentateuch, plus Joshua. Also in that series on the Torah, I mentioned that Eugene Peterson describes the Torah as conveying the stages of life in a person's life. And so Genesis represents conception, the conception of this new community of God's people. And Exodus is the birth of this new community. And Leviticus is the infancy of this new community. And Numbers is the adolescence or teenage years of this new community, the rebellious years. And then you have Deuteronomy, which is the adult stage. It's the more mature, it's the mature community of God's people. And you add that to Joshua, and Joshua is the vocation of this new community. Joshua is filled with action. The theme of Joshua is, let's go. All right, so that's the Hexateuch. Matthew models the gospel after the Hexateuch. So there are six sections of Matthew. We're dealing with the first section today. Six sections of Matthew that correspond to the six books of the Hexateuch. So Matthew 1:1 to 7:29, which Pat read selected verses from earlier, is the section one. And it represents Genesis. Only instead of being the conception of a new community, now we're talking about a conception of a new life, new person. In fact, the opening words of Matthew 1:1 are literally the book of Genesis. That's what it says, the book of Genesis. Now, it's translated usually as genealogy. But it's the word Genesis. It's the same word that's the name of the first book of the Bible, Genesis, which means beginning. Then you move on to Matthew 8:1 through 11:1. It's like Exodus. And these verses, by the way, were all part of that reading schedule I gave ahead of time, and I can get it to you again if you need to. So that's like Exodus. Matthew 11:2 to 13:53 is like Leviticus. Matthew 13:54 to 19:2 is like Numbers. Matthew 19:3 to 26:2 is like Deuteronomy. Matthew 26:3 and following is like Joshua. All right. But there's an easy way to find these sections. You don't have to memorize the numbers, but there's a phrase that each section has as its ending. And that's how we know the sections. This is very deliberate on Matthew's part. Because each section ends with a phrase, now when Jesus had finished saying these things. Your English translation may say something a little bit different, but the similarity is even more striking in Greek. It's the same thing over and over again, same equivalent idea. And Jesus finished saying these things. Now, the last section does not literally have those words, but because it's the last section, it literally is the finished, you know, teachings of Jesus. So it ends with Jesus finishing what he's saying to the disciples. It's the end of the book. And I think most of you can figure out what the end of the book is. All right. Bear with me now. I'm giving you background, trying to understand why this is such a unique book and how important it was. Matthew collected five different collections of Jesus' teachings, and he put them in the first five sections. So each section has its own collection of teaching about Jesus with a theme. Except for the very last section, which instead of being a collection of teaching, you could say is a collection of actions around the death and resurrection of Christ. All right, so the first section, the section that has the first bit of teaching is chapters 5, 6, and 7. 5, 6, and 7. And you should know the name of this section of the Bible. It has a very common name. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. It contains some of the greatest words ever spoken on the planet. The Sermon on the Mount. Now, many people think that the Sermon on the Mount embodies the heart of Christ's teaching. Now, apart from the prayer that Jesus taught disciples, which we call the Lord's Prayer, and the golden rule, do to others as you would have them do to you, the best known part is probably the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes both introduce and summarize the essence of the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount, and show us the way in which the kingdom of God makes an impact on the lives of those who respond to it. Kids in Sunday school have often been asked to memorize the Beatitudes. A little girl from Eagle, Wisconsin, tried to impress her family one night, and so she stood up and said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, For they shall come home dragging their tails behind them." Okay, those are the Beatitudes. All right, except for the last one. Beatitudes. Now, all right, so here's a setting. Matthew tells us the setting. Matthew tells us that Jesus withdrew from the crowds and sat down and then his disciples came to him. Sitting down was the typical position. Sitting down was the typical position when a rabbi wanted to talk about weightier matters. The King James Version uses a more literal rendering of Matthew's words. Jesus opened his mouth and taught them. Now that's kind of funny, isn't it? Jesus opened his mouth and taught them. Don't you have to open your mouth in order to speak? Well, unless you're a teenager, but most of us have to open our mouths to speak. Sounds redundant, sounds funny to us, but actually it's a figure of speech. It's a figure of speech meaning what follows now is really important. You need to pay attention. But it also means that what follows is a summary of what's been taught again and again on previous occasions. How do we know this? Well, we have a similar set of teaching in Luke, and that's called the Sermon on the Plain. They're not identical, they're clearly different, but enough similar to suggest this was the kind of thing that was said again and again and again and again. We also know that Jesus was a peripatetic teacher. If you're looking for a word to impress somebody at your next party, peripatetic, not pathetic, not paraplegic, peripatetic simply means he walked around. Jesus walked from place to place. And when peripatetic rabbis went from place to place, their students followed them, literally, walked behind them. And to make use of the time between villages, the rabbi would give sayings and expect the students to memorize them. They would repeat them until they knew them by heart. And so eventually Matthew got all these down and thought, oh, wait, you know, what about when we're gone? Shouldn't somebody put this on and print it so that people can read it at some future date? So he collected these teachings. That's why you have a similar verbiage in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All right. The Sermon on the Mount is about discipleship. That's the theme of the first collection of teachings. Discipleship. What does it mean to enter into a new kind of relationship with God? Jesus calls his first disciples and he sets out for them an overview of the privileges and demands of their new situation. He's looking for people to acknowledge God as their king and subsequently looking for God to fulfill his purposes for their lives. This is what Matthew means by the kingdom of heaven. Kingdom of heaven is a key phrase in this gospel. Jesus is looking for people who acknowledge God as their king. Even today, he's looking for people who will acknowledge God as their king. All right, Charles Allen. Charles Allen tells the story of Frederick William IV, King of Prussia, who once visited a school to ask them some questions. And he pointed to the stone in his ring, to a flower that he was wearing, and to a bird that passed by outside. And he asked the kids, to which kingdom did each of these belong? And the kids got the right answer. The mineral, the vegetable, and the animal kingdoms, using the language and ideas of the time. But then he looked at them and he asked, to what kingdom do I belong? They had no idea how to answer. And yet, the question remains supremely important for each of us. Matthew compels each of us to answer this question. To what kingdom do I belong?